Welcome to Witta Digital's Unsupervised, a podcast series that brings you personal perspective from the front line of modern visual effects. This is a closed door session, so come on in and shut the door behind you. My name is Maxwell Barrett, and today we'll be discussing our work on Disney's Mulan with three of our crew. Firstly, we have visual effects supervisor Anders Langlands.
It's my job to liaise with the client and take what the director's vision for the project is and translate that into how we're actually going to achieve it, and then guide the team in the most efficient way possible. I've been here for 3.5 years now.
Next, we have lead compositor Beck Veitch.
I have been here for 8 years now. My job is to look after artists that are working on sequences that I oversee, and to translate Anders' feedback into shot reality.
Interpretive
dance.
What did he actually mean by that?
Yeah. Last but not least, we have lighting lead Snowy Leo.
My responsibility includes setting up the lighting for the sequences that I'm responsible for, making sure that all the technical stuff are working properly, and also the same as Beck, tries to interpret Anders' note and making sure making sure the lighters are doing what he wants us to do. I've been at Weta for 6 years now.
So yeah, Mulan is a remake of the Disney animated film, which is based on an old Chinese story directed by Nicky Caro. Is famous for Whale Rider, a New Zealand director. And because of that, we shot a lot of stuff in New Zealand. There's a lot of beautiful locations in New Zealand, as well as stage work at Kumu Film Studios, just near Auckland, as well as a bunch of location work in China as well. And we spent 3 weeks out in China with second unit, and doing a whole bunch of scanning work out there too. Weta were responsible for about 550 shots all told, and as well as delivering those shots, our on-set team provided scanning services for the entire production as well. So doing all the LiDAR and texture reference photography, as well as photogrammetry cyber scanning of all of the cast and props. Most of our work takes place in the third act of the movie, so the big finale. We were responsible for the Imperial City, which is kind of like the backdrop for the third act, and also plays as a location throughout the movie because it's where the Emperor lives, and it's the seat of power of the Empire, and so there's a lot of action that takes place there.
I actually really like the fact that we, for one of my sequences, which was the kind of intimate romantic bridge meeting up of Hongwei and Mulan
you
at
like
the end.
You like kissing bridges, don't you, Beck?
No, I don't anymore.
You've done, I should explain, we've done 3 kissing bridges together on different films, on
yes.
War for the Planet of the Apes, Alita, and now on Mulan.
Yes, and I swear that this will be the last, unless it's an exploding bridge. But for that sequence, we were totally able to use the footage that Anders shot without having to build a lot of CG at all, which was great. A lot of the gardens and lakes behind the bridge and behind the two main characters. So that was actually really fun to do. And it was kind of old school comping work, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, it's nice to be able to have that photographic material and actually work directly from that rather than trying to just build everything in CG.
And what I liked was we were able to grade the plates to seem more, instead of studio lit, to be more evening, early morning, dawn lit. So I thought they ended up looking quite okay in the end. Quite nice.
They look beautiful. Back,
again, I'm too close to it, and it's my third kissing breach.
But no kissing on this one.
No, at last. That's the difference. Yes.
Because there was a kiss, but they took it out.
Yay.
Because it didn't test well with Chinese audiences. I was reading in the paper. That's what they've said about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it didn't test well with us either.
Hey, it was an ABA. We didn't have to do a digital human kiss, so that was fine.
Yeah. Or did we? Did we replace Mulan in that shot? We'll never know.
Who knows?
What was the city like for you, Snowy?
It was a challenge because it's quite a big environment. And, you know, like the last time we worked on Alita, when we have the big environment, we have to chop it up into like a lot of puzzles just to fit them into memory. So I think in the beginning of this project, Weta as a whole kind of decided that they want to change the way we instant stuff. And the new system actually allow us to do instancing more efficiently, and we're able to do nested instancing as well for Mulan, which is really helpful because like that massive shot in the opening scene, when you see the whole city, we actually managed to render all of that like under 100 gig, which is, if we don't have the new instancing system, that will not be possible at all.
Yeah, so that was a big technology win for us.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Compared to having to split it up into dozens and dozens of layers.
Yeah, I don't have to split up the puzzles. Like I just chuck everything into the same layers and render it. And
so basically you just got to go home early, that's what you're saying. From there.
Very little overtime is a great benefit on this show.
It's actually true.
We did not do much overtime at all.
Yeah, we don't do a lot of overtime, especially in lighting. Mm. I think most of the time we were ahead, and then at the end I feel sorry for the compers.
Everyone feels sorry for the compers.
But we are lighters and we're just like, yeah, we've done our job.
Yeah, no, it did. It ran very smoothly overall, which is nice.
Yeah. But I think a lot of it is because in the beginning we did spend a lot of time making sure that everything looks right. You know, we spent a lot of time in the beginning in the pre-pro stage as well, building the assets and, you know, make sure they match the reference. And so like at the end there's not a lot of things that we need to change.
That was one interesting thing about the show, was just how long the production period was. I was on it for very nearly 2 years total, from when we first started talking about it to when we delivered.
I think 1.5 years for me.
So it was kind of a long one, which you know, has its blessings and its curses. I think certainly one of the good things was it allowed us to take our time with the build and make sure that stuff was done right.
It certainly looks very beautiful. I mean, from a compass perspective, watching all those large city establishing shots go through this kind of times of day, it's just stunning to look at. It was really lovely, and to know that kind of quality was coming to us as well was just great. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Aww. Aww. That's really nice. We took a long time doing the builds because it's interesting that when you're trying to do something like on that scale of a city, something modern day, what you tend to do is try and find real life cities somewhere in the world that you like the look of, or the director likes the look of, and then you'll take like OpenStreetMap data for the road layout, and you'll take digital elevation maps for the landscape, and you'll blend, you know, maybe two or three different places together, you know, like a bit of Johannesburg mixed with a bit of Chicago or something like that, and you'll blend those together and form your layout based around that. Obviously, doing a medieval city in China, we don't have access to OpenStreetMap data for that. So we had to go back and look at historical research to try and figure out what this city actually would have been like. Fortunately for us, with it being the capital of the empire during the dynasty, and probably it was certainly the biggest city in the world at the time, 90 to 100 square kilometers with 1 million people living there. It's something that's been well studied because it's quite interesting. So there's a lot of material you can find in books, online, where people have published their research into it, talking about the city layout and how that was all designed and the rules that they followed at the time. The systems in the empire, everything's quite regimented in terms of city planning and based around, you know, various sort of philosophical ideals about how the city should be designed. So it's actually laid out on this big grid system with multiple districts, nine large districts divided by these massive roads that are like 150 meters across. And then those districts are then subdivided into wards, which were all had walls around them, guarded by watchtowers. And so that sort of recursive subdivided nature of it gave us like a rule set with which to build the whole city up from individual pieces. And so what we did was we took the LiDAR scans that we'd taken at XY in China for this sort of period recreation of what medieval Chinese city would be like. And we used those as like our construction kit, like our building blocks, in order to build essentially an infinite variation of buildings if we wanted to. So we could cut the scans into pieces, make low-res versions of those, and then stitch them back together again to make different variations of buildings, all the way from tiny little farmer shacks all the way up to huge palaces. And that enabled us to generate a set of homes or workplaces of different, we called them ranks, but that basically just means, you know, how wealthy we assumed the people were that lived there.
Status, wealth, I don't know, yeah, how rich they were.
Then we distributed those over the city according to another set of rules that we defined from the research, which was based on looking at maps of where various government officials and notable people lived. And then we assumed that if there's a high density of government officials living in a particular place, that was probably quite a wealthy area. And then areas where there weren't so many was probably slightly poorer. It might actually be farmland with lots of individual farmer shacks and allotments with quite small houses. And that gave us rules for spreading this stuff out to create an organic layout to the city, rather than having to try and make up the rule sets ourselves. We could base it on what the actual city was like, which is kind of neat, as well as that enabled us to find things like, where different monasteries were, because the pagodas that were sighted on the monasteries were kind of important in order to break up the skyline a little bit, because otherwise, being a medieval city, there's no skyscrapers. And if you look at just, a 100 square kilometer layout of one-story buildings, it looks pretty boring. So
yeah, I do remember a couple of daily sessions where you said, pagoda in there, please.
We had a lot of pagodas to break it all up. Yeah. But we had feature pagodas as well, which are based on, again, like a lot of our pagodas were based on historical buildings that are still actually there. Like, you can go and photograph them. A lot of them have sort of fallen down and been rebuilt in the years since they were first built. But all of the ones that are actually there are period appropriate. They're based on real pagodas that were there, either built during the Tang Dynasty or during the years preceding it as well. And that was kind of neat. Going back to all of this, taking this dive into history to try and create something that's, it's all interpretation. And of course, we did change things afterwards to make it look better. Or make it look more filmic, I guess you would say. But the broad layout of the city is based on the historical city of Chang'an would have actually been like. And so that's kind of fun to do something like an exploration like that, rather than just all making it up off the top of your head, which is kind of cool.
I kind of liked it because we got to, the matte paintings that we got for the show, it was great because we're all sitting together, so it made it really easy to communicate between the different different areas. And we got some beautiful, once I started pointing out what bamboo actually looks like.
Did you train as a botanist?
No, I didn't, but I have a deep love of bamboo that goes back to my childhood. But it was, it's just totally random. But I kind of kick Anders and say, hey, there needs to be some plants in there. And so I brought in samples of bamboo and pointed out on the some of the reference footage that we have that actually that big clump of green's not a tree, it's a bamboo. And how that got integrated into the matte paintings surrounding the city, I thought were really beautiful too. And all the misty early morning stuff was just beautiful. So what they came up with for us was just great.
Yeah, it was very helpful having anything to do with plants or horses or archery is the other thing that you're really good at.
I call bullshit on that.
It's holding the bow the wrong way.
Yeah.
But then we did look into it and decided it actually was holding the bow in the right way for the period.
Yeah.
You know, having you there with that knowledge, especially when we're looking at that reference from China, because it was, as well as going to this location, the second unit also did a bunch of excursions to particular locations elsewhere in China that feature for other parts of the film, like the location for the village where Mulan's growing up, for instance. There's some beautiful landscape around that they had
drones
out there for, that were flying over and capturing lots of reference. And that landscape actually became the basis for a lot of the vegetation that we put in around the wider city. And so being able to sort of nudge you in days and go, what's that?
I think it's an oleander.
And then, we could base, what vegetation we built and how we distributed it. Because that's another huge thing as well, is when you're doing a landscape like that, the way that the distribution of the plants is laid out is really specific to the landscape and to the type of plants that they are.
And then because you have shots outside the city and inside the city, like a gardened environment in the city and then kind of a wild environment outside, it was, we had matte paintings for both, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, the vegetation was really important just for breaking up all of the buildings, because all of the buildings are kind of samey in terms of they're all the same architectural style, because it's all very regimented. So adding some organic variation to it, just to it's kind of like visual noise, is really important when you're trying to make something of that scale. You need to give the eye enough little details to play off of, so you never just.
You don't need to notice it, you just need to...
Need to feel it,
yeah,
not
need
see
to feel it.
It.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, that's what we always absolutely. Say. Yeah.
I can't remember, it was something like 7 million trees we ended up doing in the city, I think. I read on one of our subs, there's a lot in there. And again, like you mentioned, Snowy, like the nested instancing system that they wrote for this one, so they being R&D wrote for this one, became very important for allowing layout to generate lots of these little plots. And... it's a real shame actually, because you never get the chance to really appreciate the beauty of a lot of what those layouts are in terms of like the effort and the love that they put into designing these individual little plots with the little gardens and all the decorative trees placed around.
We never get
it
close enough
paths.
To it.
No, we there was at the time we didn't know exactly what the shots were going to be when the hawk was flying over, so there was. At one point, the shot where the hawk is, we're flying with the hawk as she approaches the gate when the invasion of the city starts at the end of the film. At one point, that was flying over the city itself, and so we at that point thought we'd be seeing right down into people's gardens and seeing people on the toilet in the morning when they're getting up, that kind of thing. So we planned for putting a lot more detail in than you actually see. Directly see in the end, but I think having that detail in there, you still read in the wider city shots, just because everything's not just a carbon copy clone of itself, and there's natural structure to all of the things that are in
there.
It
looks very authentic. It's I think you do need that detail just to make it look real.
Yeah, and if you pause on the shot and try to look closer, you can see that all the district, all the little houses that actually have little ponds, little garden, like bamboo gardens, and the market as well. The market just have so many details in it.
Yeah.
Like the lanterns, the little stalls that we put in. It's impressive.
Yeah, the market was something that really... I was really pleased how that came out. Like those... Because when we were we used those rule sets that I talked about in order to design how the entire city could be generated, and that was a procedural system that layout, a guy called David Hubitz made in layout in Houdini, in order to take those rule sets that we divined from the historical research and use them to procedurally generate the entire city. And that system was really cool because it allowed us to do really broad sweeping changes to the overall city structure very quickly without having to, you know, by hand go in and move all of the buildings around. With this system, you know, quickly slice out 2 kilometers from the north-south axis of the city and have the thing regenerate all of the building placement for us. We were able to also bring everything closer. We could raise the back end of the city up in order to get the composition that we wanted for the shots really quickly, as well as doing things like changing the paths of the rivers through the city. And that became really important for, again, just adding some breakup to this very sort of grid-like pattern that the city plan was. By winding rivers through it, you can create gaps that you just notice as like a slight irregularity in the structure when you're looking off into the distance, and that really helps it feel more natural. And being able to just make, you know, really broad creative changes to the thing and have the layout adapt to that without having to worry about, you know, giving notes that were going to take people 6 weeks to achieve was really freeing creatively and allowed us to really tune the look of the city as a whole to individual shots, which I thought was really cool. And it was really speaks to the ingenuity of the layout team in that we were able to do that. I thought that was awesome. Once we'd done, you know, the whole thing and sculpted the city essentially in broad strokes, then as the edit starts to solidify and you know what particular angles you're going to be looking at, then at that point you still want to get in and just dress things by hand. So that, at that point we go back to more traditional a layout approach with, like, you know, individually placing the buildings that we want, modeling specific buildings to fit a specific purpose for where they are. So in that that opening shot where we first see the city, we designated the district on the left to be a market district, which is what you were talking about. And then the district on the right became like a military academy because Nikki wanted it to feel not just like this, wanted to feel like this sort of glorious metropolitan capital of the empire, but also feel very militaristic as well, because the military always plays a big part in the movie.
I do love that you can see these soldiers in that opening shot, you know, doing their exercises in the barracks.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, I was really glad we got that in as well. That was cool.
I really like the fact also, you know, we have so much detail in that shot and you can see it. It's great. But Jörg, the other lead compositor, Jörg Brummer, he did this fabulous thing with a flock of birds that was just 2 square planes flapping in the background. It's so lovely, and it looks exactly like a flock of birds flying away, but at the distance you can't tell.
Yeah.
It's great.
No, that was good. Cool. Yeah, we did end up flock of birds is one of those kind of cliche things you do in computer graphics to try and, you know, give scale and depth to like a map, or just to bring movement into a big map painting shot. So we did actually put a flock of birds way in the back where you can't really see it, just because I didn't want to feature it too much. But then, for those planes ended up being used in a few places, like for sparrows flitting between buildings, because that was something when we were on location you noticed a lot, like just the birds that were roosting in the awnings of all the buildings.
Oh, yeah,
nests everywhere, bird shit everywhere. Yeah. they'd just be constantly flitting between buildings, so that's something we added. And yeah, as you said, he just animated 2 planes
that's
rotating
great.
Against each other, and it looks exactly like
it
a
does.
Sparrow flying
it's
between
amazing.
Buildings. Yeah, that was really cool.
I think we need to talk about curtains.
I don't want to talk about curtains.
I think all the liars that work on the show will be like, oh my gosh, why do you guys have to talk about curtains?
Don't worry, I'll be talking about red on green soon. So.
They do look good at the end.
It does look good at the end, yeah. In spite of everything.
Next time on Unsupervised, we'll be continuing this conversation between Anders, Beck and Snowy to discuss unforeseen challenges on set, outrageous warping transformations, and definitely not curtains, because that's a sensitive topic. So stay tuned, and thanks for listening.